It's presented by Tom Service.
Welcome to a packed Royal Albert Hall for tonight's prom. Now, every prom is, of course, a special occasion, but tonight really is something extra special. For the first time in the prom's 118-year history, we welcome a visiting orchestra in residence. And what's more, they'll be playing the first complete cycle of Beethoven's 9 symphonies at the proms since 1942. It's really a huge thrill to be with you for the first instalment of the West Eastern Divan Orchestra's Beethoven cycle with their conductor and founder, Daniel Barenboim. Beethoven's first and second symphonies at either end of tonight's programme, and before the interval, music by French composer Pierre Boulez, his sumptuous, sensuous Dérive d'eux for 11 instruments. Set up in 1999, the West Eastern Divan Orchestra was the vision of Barenboim and Edward Said, who died in 2003. And the idea behind the orchestra is a simple one, to give musicians from all over the Middle East, from Israel, from Palestine, and here they come on stage at the Royal Albert Hall, this applause for them, from Lebanon, from Iran, from Syria, from Egypt, from Jordan, the chance to meet each other, to play together. And the point is the making of music, not the making of peace or even the political symbolism. However often the orchestra has been described that way, really warm applause from this full audience for the musicians of the West Eastern Divan Orchestra as they come on stage here. Now, we'll be hearing from Daniel Barenboim himself in tonight's interval. But what about the players? They're the ones who matter here, the ones whose meetings with each other define how the West Eastern Divan Orchestra sounds and the atmosphere it creates and radiates. Well, Nassib Al-Ahmadi is a cellist in the orchestra from Lebanon who's played with them since the year 2000. So how has the orchestra changed and grown in that time?
No matter how the situation in our countries, war, financial crisis, whatever is happening there, we are still sticking to each other and just carrying on with the message that we, 13 years ago, we started continuing this project and making it more known and making it more present in the world as an example for possible coherence or possible understanding of each other is very important, of course.
Even at a time when you have, I mean, the conflict between Israel and Iran, what's going on in Syria, I mean, these continual things that are happening.
Yeah, we had through the 13 years, the second intifada, then the big war in 2006 between Hezbollah or Lebanon and Israel, and then we had the Syrian revolution now, and the Egyptian revolution. I mean, there have been lots of changes in our region, but it never stopped us believing even more in the project and even investing more energy and more commitment.
Nassib Al-Ahmadi, one of the cellists in the West Eastern Divan Orchestra, who I can see on stage here and here, tuning up here at the Royal Albert Hall just in front of me. So, the orchestra are about to play Beethoven's First Symphony. A very good place to start, too, a cycle of all 9 of Beethoven's symphonies. Now, it's a piece I think has been patronised in the past, as if it were only any good because it heralds the 8 that come after it. But the thing is, the first is really the most radical of the lot. It starts not in the home key of C major, but uses that tonic as a kind of dissonance. The point is, you don't need any harmony textbooks to tell you that this opening heralds something new, a quiet pizzicato chord rather than a conventional call to attention. And that slow introduction leads into an allegro, a feverish energy. A slow movement, a menuetto that's more like a scherzo. Try dancing to this and you fall over your bowl gown. And a finale that starts with a musical gag and doesn't lead up to the finish line. Applause now for Daniel Barenboim, the founder and conductor of the West Eastern Divan Orchestra, about to start this cycle of Beethoven's 9 symphonies with the first symphony in C major.
Thank you. Thank you.
Huge applause here at the Royal Albert Hall for that performance of Beethoven's First Symphony. Daniel Barenboim conducted the West Eastern Divan Orchestra. That performance, the start of Barenboim and the orchestra's cycle of all 9 symphonies here at the BBC Proms. Reports of that First Symphony's very first performance at the beginning of April 1800 in Vienna's Burgtheater included the following gem. Beethoven's symphony contains considerable art, novelty, and a wealth of ideas. The only flaw was that the wind instruments were used too much, so it was more wind-band than full orchestral music. Well, appropriately, Daniel Barenboim bringing to their feet the wind brass, the 2 horn players, and the timpani, and the 2 trumpets of the West Eastern Divan Orchestra at that moment, because they really were stars of that performance. How can that be a flaw? The way that Beethoven uses the wind instruments as no symphonic composer, Haydn or Mozart before him, had ever done before. Well, a reminder that you can read concert programmes for tonight's prom, and indeed every prom, half an hour before Batten Up, including such gems as tonight from Richard Wigmore on Beethoven's First Symphony. Describing the end of that symphony, he says, "Just as the woodwind are engineering a poised Mozartian lead back to the recapitulation, the irrepressible agent provocateur scampers in before we realise with a general irreverence worthy of Till Eulenspiegel." More gems like that from Richard Wigmore and all the other great writers writing programme notes for the BBC Proms at bbc.co.uk/proms. Now, the second piece on tonight's programme, with Beethoven's Second Symphony coming up after the interval, is by the greatest composer-conductor in the world alive today, a musician with whom Daniel Barenboim first collaborated in the early 1960s, the French composer Pierre Boulez, who's 87 this year. We're going to hear one of Boulez's most recently completed works, his Dérive 2 from 2006. It's a piece scored for just 11 instruments, but it's some of the most dazzling, energetic, and imaginative 50 minutes or so that you could hope to hear. There's going to be a Boulez piece in five of the six Barenboim-Beethoven proms, all part of Barenboim's desire to connect Beethoven's symphonies with the present day. Thing is, that transition, though, from Beethoven to Boulez takes just a wee bit of stage management here at the Royal Albert Hall. So while the stage is reset, let's hear Pierre Boulez talking to me in an interview he gave me in Switzerland last year. I asked Pierre Boulez how he felt his music and his personal relationship with what he writes had changed over the more than 60 years of his composing career.
The ideas remain the same, and very strongly so. More stronger now than they were before, because I was not sure before. I had not the experience, and therefore what I do now is the result of a kind of idealism, let's put it this way, speculation even, and a control of the reality. I think that the life of a composer is always between speculation and reality. He speculates, he goes too far, but the going too far is a great benefit to his writing, because he knows how far he can go. You are better, you are stronger when you go further than when you are careful always not to touch the limits.
Okay, so what parts of you are in the music you write then?
What part of me?
Yeah, is
everything.
In the music you write. Okay.
Everything of mine, but I mean, if I express it by sounds, that's because I don't want to express it by words.
Okay.
Simply that.
Do you find it troubling when people hear a decadence in your music?
Decadence?
Hmm.
Why?
Because a composer friend of mine described your music as decadent, something like Derive or Sur un Cise. He hears as this almost decadent, ornamental outpouring of energy and emotion.
But I don't find that decadent. I find that, you know, like, do you find the Gothic decadent?
The Gothic style?
Architecture, yes, of the churches.
Well, in a way, yeah.
No? I don't find that decadent at all. It's more complex than Roman architecture.
True.
But I mean, that's not decadent. Maybe decadent would be a Rococo.
Okay,
Rococo well then style at the end of the 18th century, when the people did not believe anymore in the religion and they put this kind of theatrical churches, which are interesting in it for themselves, which are not very religious from a certain point.
Okay, maybe decadence, without being pejorative, not in, meant in a negative way at all, but meant probably in the sense of pleasure. I mean,
That's more complex.
The visceral pleasure.
I don't see that as a decadence.
Okay.
Because decadence means, anyway, a kind of proliferation which brings to death, more or less, yeah, that's that.
Okay.
And it doesn't bring to death, it brings, to the contrary, the life.
The stories that your music tells, recent music tells, I think I know how you're going to answer this question, but I'll ask it anyway. What do they express?
They express myself. That's all that I can say. I mean, I want to express something of mine, but I mean, I say if I could express that with words, I wouldn't express that with words. And that's music. There is what I like in music, that's very obvious in my music, that's energy. I like energy contrasted with moments of great calm, because the music of energy is still always measured with a pulse. But what I like, that music without pulse, which depends upon the instruments themselves. And therefore I like very much the resonant instruments, because they kill this measured time always. You have to wait for the resonance, for instance. I don't write any kind of value. The value depends upon what I hear and of my reaction. If I have been in a very dry acoustics, I go quicker because I cannot stand it. I mean, if there is a very good instrument, for instance, a very good piano, for instance, and a good acoustics, then I wait a little bit. I can play with that. I am free to play with my music.
Are you finally, Pierre, really a traditional composer at the end of this? This whole journey through the avant-garde and whatever we thought those things were, finally, the things you're doing with sound, telling stories, writing the pieces you want to write, expressing yourself.
You have some categories of feeling which have never changed practically. They are in a different surrounding. They use different ways of expressing themselves. But I mean, the deep soul of the man, I don't know 4,000 or 40,000 before Christ, that I cannot tell what they were thinking and how they were feeling. But I mean, if you see the monuments of literature, some of the Greek literature, for instance, 500 before Christ, well, that doesn't change very much, no? I find, at least.
Pierre Boulez talking to me last year. Well, the piece we're going to hear now, Dérive 2, was originally written for Elliot Carter, the American composer, his 80th birthday back in 1988, but it's been revised and expanded ever since then. And it's scored for the ensemble that I can see emerging down there on the Royal Albert Hall stage. There are three strings, violin, viola and cello, a percussion section of vibraphone and marimba, echoed by a piano and harp, and there's a solo horn as well as clarinet, bassoon and cor anglais. And all of them have some pretty soloistic and relentlessly virtuosic music to play. It's not, though, the first time that the West Eastern Divan Orchestra musicians, or 11 of them anyway, have played Boulez's Dérive 2. They played and recorded it in Berlin last year. It is, however, a huge challenge, and not just for the musicians, for the conductor too. When I spoke to Daniel Barenboim just after this series of Beethoven symphonies had been announced back in April, he told me, revealed to me, that he couldn't follow the score of this piece, of Dérive 2, when he first saw it and tried to follow along with one of Pierre Boulez's recordings of it. Which is a pretty astonishing admission if you think the conductor who's about to come on stage here and conduct this huge 50-minute piece couldn't even follow the score. However, I'm happy to say, having watched rehearsals this afternoon, not only could he follow the score, but Daniel Barenboim has clearly mastered its challenges. The thing is, though, for all its complexity, and the piece really does teem with a musical, shimmering, kaleidoscopic complexity. To listen to, the effect is sensual, even seductive. Boulez sets up pools of sound. The way he uses, for example, the piano and the harp and the vibraphone and marimba especially, we hear bell-like tollings through which or over which the rest of the ensemble resonate. The string instruments often have ricochet kind of figures to play, which seem to propel the forward energy of the music. And the woodwind players often have snaking, oily, triplet sounds, melodies, real melodies. Now, this is a bit controversial because people often think of Pierre Boulez's music, and indeed many of his contemporaries like Karlheinz Stockhausen and Luigi Nono, as if they didn't write melodies, as if they didn't write tunes. The thing is, in this piece that you're about to experience, there are as many, in fact there are more tunes in Dérive 2 than there are in Beethoven's First Symphony. These are proper melodies. I'm not saying they're like My Fair Lady, but they are tunes, nonetheless, that you will hear. Listen out in particular for solos for the bassoon, for the clarinet, and for the viola and the violin late on, about two-thirds into the progress of Dérive 2. Drift is the translation of Dérive. It's called Dérive 2 because Dérive 1, the first Dérive, was written for William Glock, who was a former controller of the Proms and one of Pierre Boulez's great allies when he was chief conductor of the BBC Symphony Orchestra in the 1970s. And the suite of concerts that they presented here at the Royal Albert Hall and at the Roundhouse in Camden still live in many people's memory. You're also going to experience a flow of time, which is inspired by Boulez's thinking about the music of Elliot Carter, to whom the piece is dedicated, and George Ligeti too. But to help you through the next 50 minutes or so, you can follow my tweets, which if you look at the BBC Proms account and look for the hashtag Boulez Guide, all one word, hashtag Boulez Guide, you'll see about 45 or so tweets that will accompany you through the 50 minutes that Dérive 2 lasts. A sense, too, of how important it was for Daniel Barenboim to put contemporary music, vividly, really contemporary music, this piece only 6 years old, next to the two centuries old music of Ludwig van Beethoven. Now, what that means is to try and connect the contemporary energy of Boulez's music with the still contemporary energy of Beethoven's symphonies. Daniel Barenboim's recordings of the West Eastern Divan Orchestra of Beethoven's nine symphonies are called Beethoven for All. That's not just about meaning they're for all people, but for all time too. And that's true of Boulez's music, which connects vividly with the music of the past too. Well, applause there for the 11 musicians of the West Eastern Divan Orchestra and for Daniel Barenboim. He's come on stage here at the Royal Albert Hall for this performance of Pierre Boulez's epic, sensual, beguiling Dérive 2 for 11 instruments.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Pierre Boulez's Dérive d'Heure here at the Royal Albert Hall. Daniel Barenboim conducted 11 players for the West Eastern Divan Orchestra. And he goes round each of the players now, shaking their hand, including that of his son, Michael Barenboim, the violinist and leader of the West Eastern Divan Orchestra. You know, there's a connection between that music and Beethoven's music. Boulez himself has said how Beethoven is a model creator of slow music that embraces a lot of rapid activity, as Paul Griffiths puts it in his programme note. Just one of the programme notes you can see at bbc.co.uk/proms. And a really close connection between Daniel Barenboim and Pierre Boulez. You know, watching Barenboim conduct that music, his conducting technique, he doesn't use a baton when he was conducting that chamber scale music, he does when he's conducting Beethoven's symphonies. He looks very similar to the way Pierre Boulez conducts his music, those explosive movements of his hand that somehow command all of the complexity of that music and its expression too, a real ecstatic effulgence at the end of that performance. The 11 players, headed by Michael Barenboim, come on stage here again at the Royal Albert Hall to accept this warm applause from a really full Royal Albert Hall. In fact, Barenboim appeared as a soloist with Pierre Boulez conducting here at the Proms, his second Proms appearance in 1966, playing Beethoven's fourth piano concerto. That tidbit of information, like details of every concert that has ever been played at the BBC Proms and the Proms, before it was the BBC Proms, available also on the Proms website. And that the first of five pieces by Pierre Boulez that the West Eastern Divan Orchestra will be playing between now and next Friday, and that climactic performance of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Well, it's interval time here at the Royal Albert Hall, and a chance to hear from Daniel Barenboim himself. In a Proms Plus event recorded just before the doors opened for tonight's concert, he spoke to BBC Radio 3 controller and Proms director, Roger Wright.
Let's talk about Beethoven. So when did you first encounter the music of Beethoven?
Well, I encountered his name before I encountered his music, because my parents and I lived in the same flat with my grandparents. And my grandmother, maternal side, was not particularly fond of the fact that my father had become a musician, or rather that her daughter had married a musician. And then that even her daughter started teaching music, piano, and really specialized herself in teaching children and did a wonderful job at that. And when her grandson was born, that he also, that was too much for her. And for some reason, which I never understood, and
Unfortunately, I never had the courage to ask her. She hated Beethoven. And whenever I would play something, and she would say, "What was that?" And I would say, "Mozart." Ah, good. And then for some reason, once I played Beethoven, I said, "What was that?" I said, "Beethoven." "Fui!" That was the reaction. I've always sort of, you know, it's such a stupid, childish thing I'm recollecting now, but it always remained for me that when there is an aversion to music in general, and I think particularly to such a strong composer as Beethoven, it is that strong. And this is when you get the sort of the more fanatic, the Wagner societies and the Elgarians. I mean, we know all of that. But
and this,
I am one, so it doesn't matter.
And this encouraged you.
But no, I started playing Beethoven very, very young. I had played all the concertos, I don't know, by the age of 14, 15, and the complete sonatas by the age of 17. Don't ask me how, because today, knowing what it involves, not that I claim to understand them, but I know at least what is involved in playing them, I don't know how I did it. I went to school, I finished, was my last year at secondary school, and I played all the Beethoven sonatas then.
And can you remember what that music meant to you at that time?
Well, you know, in the 50s, which is when I'm talking about, there were two sort of rather independent school of thoughts as far as piano playing was concerned, and I suppose the music too, but piano having such a large repertoire was clear. You either had a classical education and became a sort of a very small version of Schnabel, who played a little bit of Bach, a lot of Mozart, some Haydn, Schubert, but Beethoven above all, and Brahms. Or you belong to the virtuoso school, like Horowitz, and you played Chopin, Liszt, Rachmaninoff, etc. I had a very classical education from my father, who was my teacher, and the modern. In other words, I played all the sort of so-called serious music, and then I played three or four different Prokofiev sonatas. I played Bartok, I played Stravinsky sonata, all that as a child, really. Because that was the contemporary music then. Stravinsky, who was still alive, Bartok, who had died in 1945, and Prokofiev, who died in 1953. The Second Viennese School was not really played in so-called normal concerts. Those works were left for the specialized Darmstadt and Donaueschingen places, and I suppose the Proms, since Henry Wood conducted Schoenberg Opus 16 here in 1912. I was amazed when I first heard that. And that Sir John Barbarolli played the cello part in the first performance in England of the Schoenberg Kammer Symphony in 1925 at the Wigmore Hall. Amazing. But, I mean, the Second Viennese School was not really sort of deemed fit for general consumption.
and so was Beethoven then at that time just part of the piano?
Beethoven was the center of all of that. The center of all of that.
And so the sonatas already for you were part of a central piano repertoire? And
yes.
Was that your way in then to Beethoven?
Oh, definitely.
Through the piano?
Definitely. Definitely. The piano sonatas and then the concertos, the chamber music, then the symphonies, and then Fidelio, and then the Missa.
And so, as a conductor, having had that experience as a pianist, how unlike the experience of coming to it as a pianist is the business then of conducting the symphonic repertoire for the first time? Is it all part of the same world for you?
Yes and no. Yes, of course. Yes, of course, it's the same world. It's the same type of music. No, because in the end, although people speak so often of the power of the conductor, in the end, I said to the orchestra today, there was one place we couldn't sort of do it exactly as we wanted. I said, well, you know, in the end, I'm totally dependent on your willingness and ability to do it in such a way. When I play the piano, I depend only on myself. But of course, it was extremely useful for me to come to the symphonies after having had such a long experience for so many years with every other kind of Beethoven composition.
And where did your conducting of Beethoven start? With which symphony and with which orchestra?
Number 4 I conducted in the class in Salzburg in 1955, and then 8. And then I think it must have been my first so-called professional engagement. I say so-called because I'm not sure I was such a professional. It was the Second Symphony in Haifa, in the North Israel. And the first time I conducted the Ninth Symphony was in Manchester. And it was Bob Rowley, who I felt very close to, and I played with him a lot. And he said to me, he said, have you ever conducted the Ninth Beethoven? And I said, no. He said, well, you should. And anyway, he not only pushed me into it, but he gave me access, which I suppose today is much easier to get to than then. I'm talking about 1969. He gave me access to the Wagner changes of instrumentation in the Ninth Symphony. And then I conducted it in Manchester.
It's fascinating to hear you talk of your good friend and musical partner, Sir John Barbarolli, in connection to Beethoven.
Yeah.
Because I think, obviously, in the UK, we might think of him with other sorts of repertoire. And probably thinking of your Beethoven tradition, in addition to Barbarolli, then
Klemperer,
Furtwängler. So do you feel, then, in a particular line of Beethoven performance tradition?
I don't know. I don't know. Let me evade a direct answer.
I might try again later.
When I think of the piano sonatas, how I really got to know them and what was the way for me, even after I had learned them and played them, to continue growing them, were, of course, the different editions of the great pianists. You know, the Urtext editions were just beginning to come out. In the 60s, I think, the Henley edition came out. But I had the Schnabel edition of the Complete Piano Sonatas. I had Eugen Dalbert. I had some sonatas, not all, of Bülow, a lot of that. And that's really what I grew up. And at that time, I thought that all of them were part of one tradition, of one way of seeing and of playing the music, which of course is not true. It's like with the conductors also, you know, especially with conductors conducted the same orchestra, one after another, and then you feel it was the same music making, and it wasn't. I remember in the 60s when Karajan had already been about 13 or 14 years with the Berlin Philharmonic, and out in Berlin or in Vienna, they talked about the differences between Karajan and Furtwängler. But outside in London and in England, it was the same thing. It was the Berlin Philharmonic in this same line, you know. And I think both Furtwängler and Karajan both would have been horrified at being mentioned in the same sentence. No, really, you know. And so it depends very much how you look at this. I mean, I was always extremely interested in the way of reading between the lines of all these pianists that I had mentioned now, and also Edwin Fischer, whom I had the great privilege to get to know as a boy. And with the conductors, I heard Furtwängler conduct only one symphonic program, and that was the 8th Symphony, the Große Fuge, and the 7th Symphony. And I was, of course, bowled over, but I cannot claim that I knew why. I was 11 years old.
But Clem,
I liked all this. But later I understood what it meant.
But Klemperer, you saw.
Klemperer, I played all the Beethoven concertos with, and I recorded them all with him. Klemperer belonged to no line, to no tradition. He was really by himself, as actually was Furtwängler too. I think Furtwängler probably belonged a little bit to the line before that. But Klemperer, you know, Klemperer was, by the time I played with him for the first time in 1967, must have been early 67, he was already of a certain age. I don't remember exactly when he was born, but he was already of a certain age, and he had had his stroke, and he had burned himself, and all this. He was not exactly a picture of health, and he had great difficulty moving, but this monster, he was 2 meters high when he stood up. Then he would sit on the chair and he could hardly move that, and somehow the arms would come up and then they come down, and there was a sound that I had never heard before nor since. Granite. It was like stone, like solid, very sculptured stone. I can't describe it another way. Klemperer had no interest whatsoever in beauty of sound or this, all these things. It was basically this kind of very, very sculptured sound and balance. And balance.
And those are things which obviously made a big impact on you. And have you simply taken those then as part, a rich part of your own musical personality, or do you find different things?
By the time I met Klemperer, which was, as I said, in 1967, I had heard, played for, and therefore met Furtwängler in 1954. So it's about 13 years earlier, and those 13 years were the years of my sort of youth, early adult. And I became extremely fascinated with the whole musical phenomenon, Furtwängler. The non-musical side, all the problems, whether it was had been right for him to stay in Germany or not, also interested me. But for the purpose of this conversation, the music really fascinated me. And I read every word that he had written, and he wrote quite a bit, and listened to his recordings, and I was fascinated by the fact that you could not separate the thought from the emotion in Furtwängler. Very often there was a sort of very extreme agitated thing. You think, oh, that's so highly emotional. And then when you really look at the score, you realize that there was a very good structural sense for him to do so. Klemperer had none of that. And I talked to him a lot about Furtwängler, and he had no patience and no interest in that. He thought this was just Furtwängler's idiosyncrasies and Furtwängler's subjectivity, and that this had nothing to do with the music. Although he recognized that he was a great conductor. But this influenced me tremendously. And of course, like everything that one admires or is fascinated by, one tries to imitate. And I don't remember who it was that said that small talent imitates, great talent steals. Because the talent is so great that once he has stolen it, it has become his. And so I came from all this thing for footwork, and I started to try to do the same thing very often and to try and imagine what he would have thought. You know, and I was very proud of the fact that not one day passed in my musical life where in some way I was not thinking of him or what he would do with this phrase or with this transition, because Furtwängler's originality of thought had to do with the fact that he made a very clear difference between music that is that starts with a sense of being here and others that become with a sense of becoming. Furtwängler was about to and fro and about the transitions. I don't think Klemperer was so interested. I may be doing him an injustice, but I don't think he was so interested in transitions. He had a statement, the statement was finished, he turned a page, and then came the next statement. There was something extraordinarily matter of fact, but in fact, it was the fact of the matter and not the matter of fact. It's not just a silly play of words I'm doing, it was really that. And I must say that my encounter with Klemperer brought me to revise so many things and wonder whether I could not achieve a synthesis between these two great mountains, Furtwängler and Klemperer. And now I'm coming to what you really wanted to hear, the answer. And I have conducted the symphony, Beethoven symphonies, I don't know how many times. It also makes no difference. But these are works, of course, that have accompanied me all my life. I still believe that I learned to think the music in Furtwänglerian terms. But without in any way without in any way being critical of him or thinking I know better, I don't mean that way at all, I've tried in the last 5 to 10 years to see whether a lot of the abrupt changes and transitional changes that he did so inimitably, wonderfully, could not be done just with the change of color, with the change of balance, with more emphasis on the harmonic changes rather than on with extreme changes of tempo. So I'm in no way claiming that I think I do the symphonies now better than I did, and by this I don't mean, of course, to say that I did it so well before that there was no room for improvement. But I don't mean that at all, but I'm sharing with you a little bit my thought process. And I think that the musicians in the orchestra today have the technical capacity, and in this orchestra, the musical ability to think that one can make this experiment. My God, that was a long answer. I'm sorry.
Maestro Daniel Baumbohm, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Daniel Baumbohm talking to Proms director and controller of BBC Radio 3, Roger Wright, in that Proms Plus event recorded at the Royal College of Music just over the road here from the Royal Albert Hall just before the doors opened for tonight's prom. Details of all the Proms Plus events on the Proms website, where you'll also find the Proms blog and daily 3-minute Proms music guides, in addition to everything you could hope to want to discover about each prom every day. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for the second half of tonight's prom, the first concert in Daniel Barenboim's complete cycle of all 9 Beethoven symphonies. Now, of course, this is a hugely exciting prospect, playing all of these symphonies in a relatively short space of time, just a week or so. But it's also a massive challenge for the conductor and the players. The West Eastern Divan Orchestra cellist Naseeb Al-Ahmadi and Lenore Katz from Israel told me about the special relationship between this orchestra and this composer, Beethoven.
We worked a lot, so I feel like we're very ready by now to perform these marvelous pieces. And I feel that playing the whole cycle is so powerful and brings the best out of the orchestra so far. We played lots of repertoire before, but there is something about playing the complete cycle that is even more powerful.
Is it possible to say what that special thing is? Is it a combination of the music and the scale?
I mean,
the
music
thing?
Of Beethoven is very powerful in itself, and it's very classical in a sense that the orchestra has to be really disciplined. The other thing is that repeating these pieces for over, now the orchestra exists for 13 years, and we always had one of the Beethoven symphonies on tour with other programs. So this is getting like part of the orchestra. The sound of the orchestra is around the Beethoven cycle, kind of.
Does it mean something special to you then as a group coming to these pieces? I'm thinking also the recordings you released of the cycle earlier this year, Beethoven for All. I mean, there is a message going along here about what Beethoven's music means, not just for this orchestra as a symbol of cultures coming together, but even for the world. Do you feel that when you play?
Well, I feel that each symphony symbolizes something different in Beethoven's mind or ideas, and maybe this is a symbol for what each of us feels and the different people in the orchestra.
Beethoven is probably the most popular composer of all times, you know, and it's not for no reason. His music is universal, and everybody on earth is playing Beethoven and enjoying Beethoven, which cannot be said about all composers and all music. And playing them for us in this situation, in our orchestra, with the backgrounds of our political and cultural differences, it's even more meaningful, I think.
Naseeb Al-Ahmadi from Lebanon and Lenore Katz from Israel, two cellists of the West Eastern Divan Orchestra. Right, and so to Beethoven's Second Symphony. Now consider this. At the time, at its first performance in 1802, this was the longest, grandest, and loudest symphony ever written in musical history. But it's a piece whose energy, self-confidence, and sense of abandon were composed at a time of major turmoil for Beethoven. He despaired at his prospects for the future because he was aware, for the first time really, of what was happening to his hearing, and he set down his near-suicidal feelings in a so-called Heiligenstadt Testament, a letter he wrote but didn't send to his brothers. And yet the symphony's boldness belies any sense of self-pity or resignation. There's the scale of the slow introduction we hear first, the concentration of the tunes and the way they're worked in the opening allegro, the emotional range, a huge emotional range of the slow movement, the ferocity of the scherzo's third movement, so called for the first time in symphonic history, and the wildness of the finale. The whole thing is irresistible in the momentum it creates. This is a piece, just like the First Symphony, which matters on its own terms more than what it prefigures for the rest of Beethoven's symphonies. And yet, if you know those later pieces well, you'll be able to hear clues. There are even tremors that seem to look forward in time to the Ninth Symphony in what you hear in the Second, the way that B-flat major and D major are put against one another, right almost from the very start. Beethoven does a very similar thing in the Ninth Symphony. And actually, there's a wonderful thing, thinking back to the First Symphony that we heard in the first half. When that piece was first performed, it would have appeared on the program not as Symphony No. 1 by Ludwig van Beethoven, but as Symphony in C. These pieces are pieces of new music. Certainly, that's what Daniel Barenboim believes. He comes on stage here at the Royal Albert Hall now to lead the West Eastern Divan Orchestra in Beethoven's Second Symphony in D major.
Thank you. Thank you.
the end of Beethoven's Second Symphony here at the Royal Albert Hall. Daniel Barenboim conducted the West Eastern Divan Orchestra. Barenboim extends his arms to this huge Brahms audience and around his orchestra too. One Viennese critic for a magazine called the Zeitung für die elegante Welt, the newspaper for the elegant world, when the piece was premiered in April 1803, in fact, famously wrote of the Second Symphony that this was a hideously writhing, wounded dragon that refuses to die, but writhing in its last agonies, and in the fourth movement, bleeding to death. Well, it must be proof, I guess, of this audience, and speaking personally, me too, that we liked watching dragons being pummeled, beaten, and killed to death, musically speaking. That music is completely thrilling. And actually, that contemporary report catches something of the extremity of this music, an extremity and an essentialness about it, that this orchestra, the West Eastern Divan Orchestra, and its young players, and Daniel Barenboim, communicated and realized tonight. This, of course, is only the end of the first of six concerts that make up this cycle of Beethoven's nine symphonies, bit of chamber music and the music of Pierre Boulez too, that climaxes next Friday with the ninth symphony. I'll be back for all the concerts. Tomorrow night, the fourth symphony, the Eroica, and Pierre Boulez's Dialogue de l'Ombre Double. But now, from this thrilled, ravished, and dragon-wounding Royal Albert Hall, time to hand you back to John Shea at Broadcasting House.
Thank you, Tom, and we'll be venturing back into the Dragon's Den with Tom Service, Beethoven and Daniel Barenboim at the West Eastern Divan Orchestra at 7:30 tomorrow evening. Before then, in the afternoon, Mahan Esfahani will be recreating the spirit of Bach's Leipzig Coffeehouse Concerts in the first of this year's Proms Saturday matinees. He'll be playing his own arrangement of Bach's The Art of Fugue with the Academy of Ancient Music. That's at Cadogan Hall and live on Radio 3 at 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. And I see there are also a couple of Proms Plus family events. If you'd like to know how to sign up for those tomorrow, then do have a look at the Proms Guide or the Proms website, bbc.co.uk/proms. It's 3 minutes past 10 this Friday night on BBC Radio 3. The essay is 45 minutes away. But first, Tristram Hunt concludes his series this week of Great British Ideas, looking at how ideas born in Britain have spread beyond our shores. In this programme, he traces the tale of the bourgeois British liberal who inspired Lenin.
On a screen on a wall in the National Army Museum in London is an eerie piece of film. It's 1899. A square of maybe 100 British soldiers, standing stock still on a raft, are being tugged slowly across a South African river to an uncertain fate amidst ambushes and skirmishes and the sieges of the Boer War. The Empire had called.
What house to throw the gauntlet down, or what defiant spur? Not ours to give the challenge, nor battle flag unfurl. We banded for defence alone to guard our native land, nor thought of foreign conquest upon a distant strand.
This is a story in the mould of John Buchan and the 39 Steps, of gold and steel, of prospectors, colonial wars, and shadowy financiers pulling the strings of politicians, of imperial intrigue and radical liberal anger, and of revolutionaries plotting in London backrooms whose schemes will change the world. A few months before those soldiers were tugged into battle, as the British Empire and the Boer Republic geared up for war, a 40-year-old Englishman arrived to cover the escalating political crisis for the Manchester Guardian. His name was John Atkinson Hobson, and what he found in South Africa was to crystallise an idea in his mind, a vision of the true nature of empire, that was to establish the foundations of anti-imperialism, a philosophy that would come to travel the world. To rediscover the story of how this neglected English journalist had such a profound influence. I've come to the National Army Museum in Chelsea, in London, to meet Professor Peter Kane, author of Hobson and Imperialism. Peter, who was John Hobson?
Well, John Hobson was a provincial liberal. He was born in Derby, the son of a rather prosperous newspaper proprietor. And he admitted later on that in his early years he'd been rather complacent about the capitalist system and about imperialism. But when he went to London from the mid-90s onwards, he began to notice the poverty.
So he comes from the north of England with a belief in that free trade, enterprise, mid-Victorian model. He comes to London, discovers poverty and the causes of poverty, but then begins to link it to international events. How does that work?
In the early 90s, Hobson came increasingly to recognise that capitalism maldistributed income and wealth, and that meant that the masses didn't get enough of what was produced and the rich got too much. The result was that the rich oversaved. And Hobson argued that the only real outlet for this oversaving that would bring a return to the rich was foreign investment. And he began increasingly to see foreign investment as the crucial reason for overseas expansion. It was finding new markets for foreign investment and carefully protecting the places where investments had already been made.
So underconsumption at home means you have to put your money around the world, that's what's driving imperialism, and then the defence of those imperial interests.
That's right. And he had clearly worked this out theoretically as early as 1898. And it was that which interested the Manchester Guardian and was the reason why he was sent to South Africa to investigate the crisis that was beginning. Once he gets to South Africa, he really gets angry about the situation. And he begins to see the mine owners, led by Cecil Rhodes, as the key figures in manipulating the British into fighting the local population, the Dutch, in order to improve mining profits.
Because very soon after Hobson goes out into South Africa, Britain is at war. Yeah. Tell us about the genesis of the Boer War.
The argument that the British government was putting forward was that it was actually defending the rights of British subjects in the Transvaal Republic, the Dutch Republic, and the argument that Hobson put forward was that this was in fact simply a ruse, that what they were there to do was to actually improve the conditions for the mining capitalists and improve the profits of the finance capitalists. And he felt that the whole aim of the war was fundamentally economic, but people were misled into believing that there was a kind of moral purpose behind it.
Now, one of the key figures he identifies in terms of this ideology of imperialism is Cecil Rhodes. What was his critique of Rhodes and the power of Rhodes?
Well, what brought Rhodes to Hobson's attention was the famous Jameson Raid of 1895, initially, when Rhodes tried to overthrow the local Afrikaner government in order to further his capitalist interests in South Africa. And from that point on, Hobson was extremely distrustful of Rhodes. And of course, Rhodes was also a very big political figure. He was actually Prime Minister of the Cape for a considerable period in the 1890s. And so many people on the left actually see Rhodes as the chief villainous figure, if you like, as the person who epitomises economic imperialism.
Mr. Rhodes, designed to use the armed forces of the British Crown and the money of the British taxpayer to obtain for himself and his fellow capitalists that political control of the Transvaal, which was essential to his economical and political ambitions. To do this, it was above all things necessary to apply an adequate motive power to the minds of the British government and the British people. For this to work, he found the press by far the aptest instrument. John Hobson, The War in South Africa, Its Causes and Effects, 1900.
You might think the archetypal Victorian imperialist was a conservative, but Cecil Rhodes was no such thing. And as Tony Webster, a historian at Liverpool John Moores University, points out, his deeply held faith in empire was, to Hobson's frustration, held across the political spectrum.
even the political left, as represented, for example, by the Webbs in the Fabian Society, had quite strong pro-imperial leanings. And within the Liberal Party as well, that pro-imperial sentiment had become much stronger. In this respect, Hobson is very much setting himself up even against people who you might expect to be his natural allies.
Here we see a cartoon in front of us from the Illustrated London News of top-hatted city gentlemen throwing their hats into the end, and it says the reaction on the stock exchange to the news of the Boer surrender at Paardeberg, 1900. But there's rather an interesting figure on the far right of it, isn't there?
Well, there's a figure who's clearly drawn as a kind of Jewish financier, if you like. And there is no doubt about it that Hobson was quite ambivalent about this side of financial imperialism. He did show some kind of anti-Semitic strain.
And the figure we see before us is physically larger than the others. There's the crooked caricature, Jewish nose, sideburns. And he's not celebrating, he's overlooking it, as if to suggest, well, this was all in the plan. And is this meant to be, in a sense, the symbol not so much of a Rhodes as of a Rothschild?
Yes, I think so. And I think the implication is that although Rhodes is a very prominent figure, it's the senior men in the city who are fundamentally in charge of this operation, this imperialist operation.
Surely there was more than enough to critique in the imperial project and its links with the city without going down the Semitic route.
Yes, I think it was a mistake. What it reflected is the very widespread anti-Semitic sentiment amongst English intellectuals at that time. But the fact is that the theory worked perfectly well without invoking any kind of Jewish conspiracy. What you have fundamentally is what Hobson thinks of as a city conspiracy, not a Jewish conspiracy as such. And the theory will work perfectly well without introducing the anti-Semitic element.
Either way, when we look at the power on display at the stock exchange, when we look at the politicians, the financiers behind the imperial project, it suggests some of the strength of the consensus that Hobson was up against, doesn't it?
Oh, yes.
Meanwhile, a stranger arrived in the heart of the empire. On the 14th of April, 1902, here at Charing Cross Station, Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, better known as Lenin, arrived with his wife, Krupskaya, from the continent. This was a city far bigger than he had ever encountered. The weather, much like today, was dreadful. But as they stepped out into the stronghold of the great capitalist imperium, Lenin's wife records that his face immediately brightened as he began to marvel at the sheer power and scale of London. Lenin and Krupskaya got to know London by crisscrossing it on the buses. Sitting next to me, on an open-top bus pushing east through the middle of London, is Professor Christopher Reed of the University of Warwick, author of Lenin, A Revolutionary Life. Chris, what did Lenin see? What did he enjoy on these bus rides he took through the heart of London?
Well, Lenin was kind of knocked out by London. He was fascinated by capitalism. He wanted to know what its inner secrets was, and he could see everything. We're currently passing the Royal Courts of Justice, one of the great elements of the state. You could see all these great symbols of the establishment. He went through upper class areas, Knightsbridge, Mayfair and so on, and then went to the extremes of East End and other working class suburbs. And according to his wife Krupskaya, when they were sitting on the bus, he would mutter to himself, "Two nations, two nations."
As we cross Ludgate Circus and head towards St Paul's, this shimmery view of the power and might of Protestant imperial London, did his time here inform his analysis of empire?
Well, I think as his comment about the existence of two nations showed, it really brought home to him what he believed was the fundamental feature of the modern imperial capitalist world, which was class. There are the wealthy, the people who are, in his view, living off the extracted surplus of the workers. And then you go to the working class suburbs and there are problems, there are drunkenness, there's overcrowding,
There was a sense at the time amongst social critics, cultural critics, of London as Rome, both this city of great imperial might, but also full of decay, also full of corruption, and this notion of capitalism as somehow a parasite as well, and its relationship with empire. Tell us about that.
Well, this certainly was something which Lenin was very well aware of, that he was kind of contemptuous, particularly because of the weight of the financial sector, that the financial sector simply takes the profit from what everybody else does.
As we pass by St. Paul's Cathedral, and you only really get the enormity of on the top
Absolutely,
of a bus.
Yes, yes.
Did Lenin also get a sense of just what he was up against? That the power and might of empire as evinced by these great buildings, this city landscape?
Well, I must say, if I was a revolutionary coming round here, I think I'd be pretty intimidated by the size, the wealth, the power. But Lenin wasn't. That's the curious thing about it. He believed firmly that the workers were the majority, they would come to realise their situation, and they'd tip it all upside down and take it over and use it for the public good rather than for private benefit.
We're now heading straight up towards the Bank of England, that great classical might of London as the new Rome, the Corinthian columns, the absolute institutional core of imperial finance capitalism. Did Lenin get that sense of an entire culture enmeshed in imperialism?
Oh, he absolutely certainly did, yes. It wasn't just a group of financiers. The whole system, the monarchy, the military, the church, the establishment as we would think of it, were all integral parts of this great imperial web.
Not all of Foreman's menace are beating heart of balls. We're ready to go forward when the empire calls.
So we have this great imperial city whose politics, finance, even architecture presents an overwhelming consensus underpinning the empire. And these two men, Hobson and Lenin, both critical of it in their different ways. I've come now with Professor Peter Kane to Conway Hall in Red Lion Square near the City of London. Peter, we're sitting on the stage of the South Place Ethical Society. The group moved here in the 1920s from nearby in the City of London. And this was the kind of venue that Hobson would have addressed those interested in his critique of capitalism. It seems he almost began a speaking tour on his return from South Africa to give people the truth about the imperial project.
Yes, he came back very impassioned and he was angry, and he certainly spent time giving speeches in meetings in London, which were attacked often by the supporters of imperialism. He took his message wherever he could in London, in order to try to get across the fact that, as far as he was concerned, imperialism was an immoral project, that it was an attempt to mislead the public, that it was exploitative, and that really it should be condemned outright. Hobson is on a moral crusade, there is no question about that.
And we should probably point to the quite violent urban culture which surrounded some of these ideas. If we think of Mafeking and the celebrations, if we think of the jingoism, the music halls, the parades, meetings being attacked, this is politics in the raw often. Mm.
Yes. I mean, Hobson was appalled by the kind of public clamour for imperialism, and he felt it was incited by the press, and that people were encouraged to go out and be violent against their opponents.
So does Hobson manage to bring together his articles, his speeches, into a single thesis, into a work?
Yes, despite having a kind of frantic lifestyle and publishing all over the place, he did manage in 1902 to produce this book called Imperialism, a Study, which brought together all his leading ideas on imperialism, whether they were economic or social or political. And that has become, in many ways, one of the great standard texts of anti-imperialism.
What opposition was he coming up against in terms of his criticisms of empire?
Well, if you take the liberal movement as a whole, including the Liberal Party, then the party was very seriously split over the question of imperialism. And it's probably true to say that more liberals believed in imperialism than stood on Hobson's side in this matter. For instance, he had a very big confrontation with David Ritchie, who was a quite famous philosopher at the time,
in which Ritchie defended the Boer War and the imperialism project as part of the civilizing mission. And he saw empire as simply a kind of natural outcome of Britain's prestige and power in the world.
Leonard Settis grew up in 1900. It was very important to him. It was the key centre of his life, actually, to produce the party newspaper.
And this is the room where he edited Iskra in 1902-1903.
That's right, yes.
Back with Christopher Reed, I went to visit the Marx Memorial Library, just west of the City of London, in the old radical stamping ground of Clerkenwell Green. In 1902, when he wasn't sightseeing on the bus, this was the place where Lenin spent most of his waking hours, producing the Communist Party newspaper Iskra. But while he was in London, it seems he also found time to keep up with the work of at least one British economist.
Well, Hobson's work was a sensation when it was published, and not many people agreed with it, but it made a big splash, and I think we can assume that Lenin had one of the early editions and read it very early on in 1902. Just to find out what was going on. And I think perhaps because of the criticism which Hobson got from certain quarters, Lenin thought it must be good. If somebody's your enemy, the enemy's enemy is your friend.
So we have Lenin in London reading Hobson's Imperialism, study, maybe even in this room, but certainly beginning to think about the ideas and the rationale and the criticism of finance capitalism behind it.
What Hobson gives to Lenin, two things, I think, essentially. One is that this great expansion of imperialism in the 80s and 90s was linked to the latest phases of capitalism, particularly the increasingly desperate search for profits, as Hobson saw it, the theory of underconsumption, that the metropolitan countries were not buying enough, the profit rates were dropping. Competition was becoming more intense, driving capitalism into the rest of the world, and a capitalism which was increasingly fierce, racist, aggressive, all the things which Hobson had blamed the British Empire for in its treatment of the Boers in the Boer War.
By 1904, Lenin had left London for Switzerland, where he laboriously set about making a translation of Hobson's work. But in England, interest had waned. Hobson's book had fallen on such stony ground that even its author soon abandoned his lonely assault, leaving the great edifice of empire unscathed. But then, a decade later, the Empire's call reverberated across Europe. In 1914, the imperial powers of Austro-Hungary, of France, Germany and Britain, Russia and the Ottoman Empire went to war. Suddenly, the dust was blown off Hobson's forgotten polemic.
Hobson's deep foreboding in his 1902 work about the dangers of imperialism leading to conflict seemed to come to fruition. And I think Lenin's championing of his work really emphasises that in a very, very strong way.
As the Great War ground on, it galvanised Lenin, bringing the question of imperialism back into immediate focus. In 1916, he issued his response, a book called Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism. Evidence of the impact of Hobson's thinking is laced through the book. In Hobson, he found crucial support for his argument that the First World War was an imperialist war, driven by desperate financiers, and that it marked capitalism's zenith before its inevitable collapse. And so the anti-imperial critique of John Hobson, liberal economist, Guardian journalist, and thoroughly bourgeois Edwardian, was about to exert a profound influence on the communist revolutionary leader.
There is almost a whole chapter devoted to discussing the bits of Hobson that Lenin found really interesting and which he incorporates into his thinking in a very fundamental way?
For Lenin, the really important thing that Hobson identifies is the importance of a small clique of financiers who were able to dictate and determine state policy in imperial terms. And the notion that these financiers are parasites is something that Lenin very strongly emphasizes.
Hobson does discuss capitalism as a kind of parasitic entity, and as though Western capitalism was actually battening on Asia and Africa and sucking the life out of these economies.
Lenin fused Hobson's ideas with those of another thinker, Rudolf Hilferding, to forge a new Marxist version of anti-imperialism.
For Hobson, imperialism is the disease. For Lenin, it's capitalism which is the disease. And for Lenin, it's impossible to reverse imperialism without actually destroying capitalism.
Within a year, Lenin had swapped theory for practice as he boarded a sealed train to make his way from Switzerland to Russia, a nation now in the throes of political chaos, with the Tsar toppled and a provisional government in power. Life for foreigners from the imperialist states, as for many Russians, was becoming distinctly frightening. Margaret Maund was a young British teacher stranded in Moscow, as she recalled 40 years later.
Crossing the bridge, I saw the sight, of course, I shall never forget. There was crowds throwing stones, and in the ice there was a hole, and at the edge of the ice I could see a big hand. So I presumed it was a man, and they were throwing stones and trying to hit his hand, wanting him to go right under the water. And I made a step forward, and I must have said something, because suddenly my arm was taken very firmly by a Russian, and he rushed me over the bridge. And he said, "Don't be a fool." He said, "You can't do anything against the mob." He said, "This is mob law, and we'll see lots of blood before the end." And just before I did cross the bridge, I looked back and the hand had gone. Then Lenin arrived, via Germany, of course, and then things seemed to change. The far more brutal things were said and far more brutal things were done. People were insulted in trams, people were insulted in the street. The officers had their epaulets torn off and trampled. One saw that, and I felt that something far worse was coming.
And Lenin found the new regime still fighting the war.
It's the reason he gives for not supporting the provisional government that takes over from Tsarism. It's still an imperialist war, he argues. They're still fighting for English and French capital, and that English and French capital have hired the troops of Tsarism to do its dirty business for it in competition with Germany.
Once Lenin comes into power in 1917, he's faced with a massive internal crisis with the outbreak of civil war. A civil war, moreover, in which some of the Western powers appear to be supporting quite enthusiastically the anti-Bolshevik forces.
And then gradually they became very anti-British. And things got really, very bad.
Back in Lenin's old office in London, Christopher Reed and I listened to a recording of him in action from March 1919, railing against the imperialist powers of England, America and France.
Товарищи Красной Армии, капиталисты Англии, Америки, Франции ведут войну против России.
By then, of course, Lenin was in every sense a long way from this small little box room in Clerkenwell. How is he making use of Hobson's ideas in this context?
I think the main element of Hobson that he gets is the unadulterated ferociousness of capitalism, the fact that it will do anything in its own interests. And unfortunately, this, of course, has a kind of inverse effect on Bolshevism itself, which has this very hostile view of capitalism, believes that in order to fight against imperialism, it too has to be absolutely ruthless. And the ruthlessness of the Bolsheviks, in part, arises from their understanding of what imperialism was. And nobody was a bigger critic of the aggressiveness of imperialism than Hobson himself was.
with Lenin in control of the Kremlin, the diplomat Sir Robert Bruce Lockhart arrived with the unenviable task of trying to establish relations between the British Empire and its would-be nemesis.
On the question of intervention by consent, I had to see Lenin, who was frank but obdurate. His answer was very simple. No intervention unless the Germans try to oust the Bolshevik regime by force.
And this Hobson-influenced view cast a decades-long shadow at the top of the Soviet Union.
What Lenin learns from Hobson contributes to a very deep suspicion of the West within the Soviet Union that has quite important long-term consequences.
They constantly saw it as an imperialist versus anti-imperialist struggle, and they were the leaders of the anti-imperialist forces.
But the impact of the anti-imperialist ideas of Lenin, influenced as they were by John Hobson, spread far beyond the new Soviet Union. They travelled south, back to the very heart of the British Empire. Here, to New Delhi, the new imperial capital of India. Across the road from me is the Sansad Bhavan Parliament House. In front of me is that extraordinary design of neoclassicism and orientalism that defines New Delhi, the North Block of the seat of government, standing in front of the Viceroy's house and looking out across Delhi towards India Gate. Today these are the buildings of an independent Indian government, but built by the British in the early 20th century. With me is the historian Dr. Shruti Kapila of the University of Cambridge. Dr. Kapila, in the Edwardian era, as Indians were setting out on the long road to independence, before this building was actually built, what was the tenor of Indian anti-imperialism?
Primarily, the critique of empire was economic, predominantly. Whether you look at the moderates who were constitutionally minded, or the extremists who were more radical in their means for political independence, nevertheless shared beyond their divisions in the fact that imperialism was basically an experience in economic impoverishment. So by the time, as it were, Lenin shows up, there is a long pedigree of thinking about the empire vis-a-vis the economy.
So you have this indigenous critique, you have this indigenous criticism of the economic exploitation of empire. Does Lenin and the events in Russia give it a spur, take it in a different direction?
Yes, I think there is, as it were, a kind of climate of opinion in which, as it were, Lenin finds a great resonance with thinking going on in India. From Lenin, you get the other, as it were, a generalized idea that imperialism is an absurd polity itself.
The influence of Lenin on Indian nationalists is particularly clear in the case of the man who would become independent India's first Prime Minister, Jawaharlal Nehru. In the 1930s, his thinking about imperialism bore a distinctly Leninist tinge, not least in a famous speech he delivered in Lucknow in 1936. In Nehru's address to the 49th session of the Indian National Congress, he roundly declared that the capitalist order had inevitably developed into vast imperialisms, which, having swallowed the colonial world, were intent on eating each other up. Powerful still, and fearful of war, which might endanger their possessions, yet they came into inevitable conflict with each other and prepared feverishly for war.
That speech does betray a debt to Lenin. Nehru was clear that imperialism and capitalism were two sides of the same coin. To that extent, he agreed with Lenin.
The Leninist critique of the First World War was always that this was an imperial war, that this struggle for resources, for colonial resources, made it an inevitable product of capitalism. Did Nehru connect up this warmongering with imperialism?
Absolutely. Nehru did see the war as one which was driven by imperial capitalism and a competition between emergent imperial powers. And this is why I think that Nehru also fashions a unique foreign policy after Indian independence of non-alignment, because in a way, while it was had a critical distance from America and Britain, it was sympathetic but distant from also the communist world because it didn't want these ex-colonial societies to fall back into that imperial war game.
So Hobson's attack on imperialism resonated as far as Russia and India. But it also found its way back to the ever more febrile political scene here in the capital of the British Empire. In the 1930s, the appeal of the empire was beginning to pale. And in the face of the Depression, many younger British intellectuals moved left, turning to the likes of Lenin for inspiration. Men like John Strachey. In 1932, he published a book which sought to popularise the Marxist message. This was The Coming Struggle for Power. Strachey's book had a huge impact, reading the last rites for a supposedly dying capitalist system, struggling to survive through its imperialist conquests. I've come to Hyde Park in central London, where Strachey's ideas found a new audience in the mid-1930s. Not far from me is Speaker's Corner, where debates about capitalism and imperialism were held in front of hundreds. And in front of me, the Albert Hall, where rallies of left and right took place month after month. With me is Professor Noel Thompson, biographer of John Strachey, and we're going to take a walk now to see where some of these ideas about capitalism and imperialism suddenly became the stuff of running battles and police charges. Professor Thompson, who was John Strachey?
John Strachey was one of the most prominent left intellectuals in Britain in the early part of the 20th century. Coming as one has to say, so many of them did, from an impeccably upper-middle-class background. He was the son of Evelyn St. Lo John Strachey, the editor of The Spectator. It was in the 1930s that he really came to prominence. By then, he'd abandoned his social democratic reformism. He was a communist fellow traveller, though not a member of the Communist Party. And it was during this period in the 1930s that he produced his most important work that sold not just in their thousands, but in their tens of thousands. And they had a major influence within the left.
And this was a Leninist critique of imperialism? This was an economic critique of imperialism that he was popularising?
Strachey was someone who had read Lenin's work carefully, and in particular his 1916 work on imperialism, and this formed the basis of his critique of capitalism in the 1930s. He absorbed the central elements of what Lenin had to say about the economic drivers of imperial expansion, and he saw those as precipitating Britain and other empires in the direction of a major conflict which he believed would ultimately undermine the basis of capitalism, not just in Britain, but globally.
So how did imperialism and Strachey's analysis of imperialism work to undermine capitalism?
Imperialism was providing an economic basis to prop up the capitalist system. However, imperialism gave only a breathing space because ultimately it would precipitate a conflict between the major powers as they looked to establish control over particular areas of the globe. What Strachey does is to link this struggle for empire to the emergence of fascism in Britain and in continental Europe as well, because fascism, for Strachey, represented the gearing up of nations for the kind of conflict that was inevitable as they sought to maintain and extend empire.
Where does J.A. Hobson fit into Strachey's thinking?
Strachey takes on board the idea of imperialism. He takes it on board from Lenin. It is, in a sense, a Russian import. This is an idea that has been influenced by Hobson, but he uses it to articulate a catastrophic view of the future of capitalism. So, if you like, he re-imports the Hobsonian idea of imperialism and uses it to do damage to the kind of positions which Hobson himself is taking up in the 1930s.
We've now reached Thurlow Square in the shadow of the Victoria and Albert
museum, a rather tranquil, exclusive residential London square now. But in 1936, it was a very different scene here.
A very different scene. On the 22nd of March, there would have been a crowd of 2,000 to 3,000 here. No doubt banners, no doubt chanting. Strachey was one of a number of speakers that addressed this crowd. They were aware of what was going on not very far away in the Royal Albert Hall, a major assembly of the British Union of Fascists addressed by Sir Oswald Mosley. And Strachey and those others were here there to express their total opposition to and repugnance for fascism. The demonstration was peaceful to begin with, but there was a series of disturbances that erupted. This resulted in mounted police charging with batons. A number of the demonstrators were arrested and appeared in Kensington Magistrates Court, and questions were asked in Parliament.
So in the context of the 1930s, the Depression, the tensions you're seeing across Europe, the question of imperialism is creating violent and often bloody political division on the streets of London.
It is a focus for political division. For the right, it is the solution to the difficulties that British capitalism is experiencing. For the left, it is what will precipitate its ultimate demise.
The world has changed out of all recognition since the days of Mosley and Strachey, the struggle for and against imperialism and fascism on the streets of London. How has Lenin's broadside against imperialism as the final stage of capitalism fared? Tony Webster.
Lenin assumes, as most Marxists did, that the fate of the masses of the population under capitalism would be very dire indeed. This would be the reason why the workers would basically overthrow the capitalist system. The trouble with this, of course, is that it's not what happened. In actual fact, capitalism proved to be far more effective at generating so much wealth that even the poorest people in society could have some kind of share in wider prosperity. And this is something that I don't think Lenin or indeed Hobson necessarily foresaw. And certainly in the long term, capitalism proved to be very, very effective at raising the living standards of large numbers of people, particularly in Western societies, and effectively removing the kind of political pressures that Lenin hoped for that would bring capitalism down.
Even so, in some parts of the world, anti-imperialist rhetoric is still going strong. Back in India, the fundamentals of Lenin's economic assault on empire are enticing a new generation.
Lenin is very much part of the fabric of thinking about international politics in India today. And in a way, he never went away right from the 20s, 30s onwards, providing, as it were, a framework of thinking about the world in which anti-imperialism, economic thinking would be put together by every new generation of writers and thinkers. And this is to say that Lenin is not a fringe figure for Indians. And, you know, when you go down to Kerala, there are men named after him.
I'm on the leafy campus of Jawaharlal Nehru University in Delhi. And on the walls of the social science school, I can see a poster advertising a public talk entitled Unmasking the Empire, US Hegemonic Strategies, Then and Now, by Professor Leo Panitch. And in front of me, a series of frescoes, one depicting This is Capitalism in the Coca-Cola icon, with a McDonald's symbol above it and a starving child. And the text is Recognize this face of violence without bullets, the violence of super profit for few, the hunger for the myriad rest. A Leninist notion of the economics of imperialism under the modern corporation. And in magazines like Liberation, the organ of the Communist Party of India, Marxist-Leninist, the attack on American economic imperialism, so-called, is distinctly, well, Leninist.
The power of empire shifts. In the 19th century it was Britain, in the 20th century America, in the 21st century maybe China or India. But criticism of its impact and effects at home and abroad is curiously consistent. Whether it is Lenin lambasting the European powers or Hugo Chavez taking on the West, for some, the spectre of economic ambition behind all the talk of civilization and improvement is always there. But I wonder how many of today's fiery young Leninists, in Delhi or Caracas, have read the works of that fastidious liberal Edwardian J.A. Hobson. 100 years on, could he still claim his detailed critique of the financial drivers behind empire is right? And even if he couldn't, does his thinking still have an influence? Peter Kane and Tony Webster.
One of the problems with Hobson's thesis is that Hobson is looking at places in Africa and Asia where imperialist expansion has taken place in the last 20 years or so of the 19th century. The great problem is that a great deal of capital export didn't go to these parts of the world. Much of the capital export goes to countries like the United States, to parts of Europe, to South America, into parts of the world where it's much harder to argue there is a strong British imperial influence. So there's a certain, shall we say, weakness there in Hobson's analysis.
One of the reasons put forward is that we're really there in Iraq for the oil and that it's our economic interests which matter, or defending them. And this can be expressed in very Hobsonian terms. And in fact, in many ways, given the collapse of the Soviet Union and given the collapse of the kind of intellectual authority of Marxism, people like Hobson have actually come more to the fore when you're talking about economic imperialism in recent years.
Great British Ideas was presented by Tristram Hunt, MP. The reader was Sean Baker, and the programme was produced by Phil Tinline. The series was first broadcast last year. This is BBC Radio 3 at just after 13 minutes to 11. Now, the essay. This week, in Under the Influence, three artists working in different disciplines have been reflecting on people, movements or ideas that have an impact on their work. To conclude the series, here's Kai Miller, the Jamaican poet and novelist who now lives in Glasgow.
Listen to a poem. It's After the Alphabets by the American poet W.S. Merwin. If you wish, you may create a sort of prequel. You may imagine that a cricket has flown into the house, is hiding between the books on a shelf, and is making the kind of noise that rouses us from the sofa. Imagine seeking the cricket out, and upon finding it, being suddenly curious. You lean in closer as if to listen. Here is the poem. I'm trying to decipher the languages of insects. They are the tongues of the future. Their vocabularies describe buildings as food. They can depict dark water and the veins of trees. They can convey what they do not know, and what is known at a distance, and what nobody knows. They have terms for making music with the legs. They can recount changing in a sleep like death. They can sing with wings. The speakers are their own meanings in a grammar without horizons. They are wholly articulate. They are never important. They are everything. If your first experience of that poem is anything close to mine, then you would have felt as if you came close to meaning, but that at the very end it had slipped you. And because you felt that between this elegant poem and yourself something slightly clumsy happened, you would assume that the clumsiness was your own. You would say about the poem, it isn't that the words are trying to be obscure in any way. They aren't. But perhaps they gesture towards something so large, it becomes difficult for our small hands to hold it all at once. The poem's last three declarations, they are wholly articulate, they are never important, they are everything, are particularly wonderful. How they at once seem to backtrack and yet build progressively, how they at once retract each previous statement while extending it. On my first encounter with this poem, what I was left with most profoundly was the experience rather than the meaning of it. But experience inside a poem is a hard thing to talk about, and experience is a bloody hard thing to create, if you decide that this is the business you are about doing. Now let us be clear. It's not as if we can't extract a coherent meaning from Merwin's poem. It imagines some apocalyptic future in which we, the human race at least, is gone. And in this future, as entomologists have been telling us for a while, the insects have survived. Perhaps this is why there are so many poetic elegies to insects, John Donne's flea or Dorian Law's mating beetles. For Merwin, it is the languages of insects that interest him, the ways that insects communicate in absolutely necessary ways, in sounds that always mean something, that are never just adornment, that are always utterly honest. This language, for Merwin, is superior to ours. Perhaps the irony is that in a poem that seems to celebrate plain-spoken simplicity and unencumbered meaning, that these weren't the things I left with immediately. But what I did leave with brought me back, again and again. I had a sense of what the poem did before I had a sense of what it said. And this was strange, because for me it was the recognition of something I had always pretended to believe in. From quite early I had read Suzanne Sontag's brilliant essay Against Interpretation, and had been largely convinced by it. If nothing else, her argument was arsenal against my A-level literature teachers, who kept on asking, "Kai, what does the poem mean?" Or, "What is the poet saying in this line or in that line?" And I would say, all precocious, with a haughtiness I hadn't earned, only wanting to make trouble, "Surely, miss, the question we must ask of art is not what does it mean, but rather what does it do?" Still, before Merwin, that question had always been academic for me. After Merwin, I was suddenly converted to my own rhetoric, or perhaps I finally saw how it applied to poetry as well. I had applied it more willingly to visual art, especially the abstract. In that area, I no longer felt the compulsion to interpret, for instance, a red brushstroke as some kind of female subjectivity tinged with angst, or the use of circles as representing the mother figure, or the use of greys over everything as representing the kind of stifling that people have had to endure. I was liberated from the need to interpret incessantly, in a way that the whole time was separating me from the simple enjoyment of how colour and shape could be balanced against each other, or the voyeuristic joy of seeing the world through someone else's eyes. But words, unlike acrylic or oil, have set meanings, and poets, after all, for the most part, are trying to say something. But is it possible to experience a poem fully that you haven't understood fully? I confess now that my favourite Merwin poem is not one that I could ever confess to understanding fully. It's from his 1963 collection, The Moving Target, and it's called My Friends. It's another elegy, this time for those who seem to have been shortchanged by the world, those who have been broken, those who have had to make their way throughout each day without fathers or gloves. And Merwin claims them, the least of these, as his friends. The poem is a litany. It's a simple list that gathers a sort of momentum, both rhythmically and perhaps spiritually. It's not a structure that is unique to Merwin. Almost all poets have done something similar, but I think now that when I began to steal this structure for myself, I was stealing it from him. The poem, it's a long one, but it ends like this. My friends without fathers or houses hear doors opening in the darkness whose halls announce, "Behold, the smoke has come home." My friends and I have in common the present, a wax bell in a wax belfry, this message telling of metals, this hunger for the sake of hunger, this owl in the heart, and these hands, one for asking, one for applause. My friends with nothing leave it behind in a box. My friends without keys go out from the jails. It is night. They take the same road. They miss each other. They invent the same banner in the dark. They ask their way only of sentries too proud to breathe. At dawn, the stars on their flags will vanish. The water will turn up their footprints, and the day will rise like a monument to my friends, the forgotten. I am always so moved by this poem, which seems to say exactly what it wants to say, but I can never condense it. Not having to obsess about interpretation, I could contemplate how the poem did the things which it did inside me. I could observe more closely the ways Merwin would make quotidian things grow as large as myths, how he made absent fathers become smoke, and a smoke which the darkness, suddenly assuming the role of a butler, announced. Or sadness becomes an owl in the heart. We almost feel its large feathers fluttering against our chest, and we hear the plaintive woo. I could now observe the simplicity and oddness of his images, simple enough that we could conjure it, but odd enough that we were forced to contemplate it. And it is this ability to cause movement in the reader's minds, to create for us an experience, that impresses me most about Merwin's art. Merwin's influence keeps on showing up in my poetry. When I wrote my last collection, A Light Song of Light, I composed a sequence that may seem on the surface to be absolutely interested in meaning, though the poems are actually more interested in creating experiences. I call them my definition poems. On the page, I set them out to look like dictionary definitions, and they pretend to do this glossing work, gathering together some real and some fictional definitions of the things they are ostensibly defining. But they are litanies as well, lists with their own momentum. I was interested in how images could be layered against each other, and how I could at least try to transform the everyday into the mythic. And perhaps with a title like Some Definitions for Song, I was suggesting perhaps that there is your meaning. The poem is in fact a compilation of meanings, so let's get past that and into the experience. Here is that poem, Some Definitions for Song. The speech of birds, as in bird song, but with exceptions. Pigeons do not sing. Vultures do not sing. A bargain or a very small sum, as in he bought it for a song. Think what we could purchase with songs thrown across the counter and landing more softly than coins. Perhaps then the origin of the expression to sing for your supper. The troubled sound that escapes from a woman's mouth while she dreams of fire, also any sound that escapes, also anything that escapes, a passage out, the fling up of hands, a prison break is a song. The parting of the Red Sea was a song. In Israel, there are many songs, but there should have been 6 million more. Across the Atlantic, there are many songs, but we needed 10 million more. Song was a state during the Eastern Zhou spring and autumn period, 770 to 476 BC. Its capital was Shangku. Anything that climbs is a song. Vines are a song.